And we talked about how critical it is to lose baryons. And somebody actually came up to me after the Skeptics Forum and said, I never knew how important it was to get rid of baryons. So, but I'm going to talk about something that's probably a little closer to home today, not about how important it is for galaxies to lose their baryons, and in particular for our galaxy to lose exactly the right amount so that you get an advanced life, but to talk about leaf litter. And this is a paper that was published by someone in Panama and someone in the United Kingdom, and it had to do with a study of leaf litter in tropical, subtropical forests. So this is one of my photos of a subtropical forest, and you can indeed see there's a lot of leaf litter there, actually a little too much leaf litter for that forest's own good. And this is, I think, only the fourth long-term evolution experiment ever done. You heard me speak in the class. One of the ways we can put to the test some of the claims we see in the Psalms and the book of Job about how God's responsible for all life. It's not a product of evolution or a natural process. It's to actually do these long-term evolution experiments. And the benefit of that is, according to Genesis 1, God creates for 6 days and rests on the seventh day. That's the seventh day where he stops performing physical creation miracles. Doesn't mean he's not doing other things. This is the day in which God brings about the end of all evil and suffering. But for 6 days, he miraculously intervened in designing and upgrading of what he had created. Now, the benefit of long-term evolution experiments is one thing we know from a biblical perspective. God is ceasing from his work of intervention in the physical realm, which means all we're going to see in present-day experiments are the natural process. And so it gives us an opportunity. Are we seeing something today different than what we see recorded in the past, either through astronomical observations or through geology or looking at the fossil record? Do we see a distinguishable difference? Now, the longest long-term evolution experiment has now been running for 22 years. Now it's an experiment on E. coli bacteria. They're continuing the experiment. We talked about it here in the class. We've described it in my book, More Than a Theory. This particular long-term experiment only ran 5 years and didn't run quite long enough, but they're continuing to run it. And what they did is they took a subtropical forest and divided it up into a whole lot of subplots. So they basically carved off a few acres in each different section of the forest. And then what they did is, in one case, they kind of just left the forest alone. In the other subplots, they would artificially remove a measured percentage of the leaf litter. And in other subplots, they would artificially add more leaf litter. And what they discovered is that if you take away the leaf litter, then there will be less nitrates in the soil, and there will be less nitrogen compounds in the soil. And nitrogen is a primary limitation on the growth of the forest and the plants that the forest supports. As you can see in this photo, we not only have trees, you have a lot of shrubs, and you have a lot of ground plants. All of those botanical organisms need nitrogen. And they need the nitrogen in certain form. And a lot of that nitrogen they gain through the leaf litter. And so what they're able to show is you've actually enhanced the leaf litter. You've got more nitrogen and nitrogen compounds going into the soil that the plants could use, and you actually got a healthier and a forest with a greater biomass. And if you took away the leaf litter, then it would substantially reduce the amount of nitrogen. So they were able to show a correlation, a tight correlation between the amount of leaf litter and the amount of nitrates and nitrogen compounds in the soil that could fertilize the growth of the forest of plants. However, they only ran the experiment for a 5-year period. If they'd run it for a 20-year period, what they would have seen is the problem of too many leaves piling up on the forest floor. Now, a separate study, not one that's in this particular paper, actually looked at that. What happens when you've got too much of an accumulation of leaf litter on the forest floor? Two important things happen. Number one, the seeds falling from the plants can't make it to the soil. If they land on the leaf litter, then they're not going to sprout. And so too many leaves on the forest floor will be a problem. The other thing is if you get a large accumulation of leaf litter, and what really counts is how long it accumulates. Not so much how much leaf litter you have as how long it remains on the forest floor. Yeah. Well, see, the 5-year experiment wasn't long enough to measure the impact of decaying leaf litter. And what they're able to show is that if you have leaf litter that accumulates for a long time and decays, it releases toxins. And these toxins kill the bacteria that nitrify the soil. And so the bottom line is this. If you've got too much leaf litter accumulating, it's going to limit the amount of nitrogen compounds to fertilize the forest because you're killing the microbes that nitrify the soil. On the other hand, if you don't have enough leaf litter and you don't get enough nitrates and nitrogen compounds from the decay of the leaf litter itself to the soil. So it shows you that there's an optimal fine-tuned amount of leaf litter that is ideal for fostering the growth of the forests around the world. Now, a third study that was done, so there's really three separate studies. A third study that was done was one on how nature, if you want to use the word, quote, nature, takes care of too much leaf litter. Basically, it happens through forest fires. Forest fires will come in and consume all the leaf litter. The leaf litter is basically the stuff that burns first. And the longer it's been since a forest fire has happened, the more devastating the fire. Why? Because you've got a whole lot of leaf litter accumulated, and that stuff burns easily. It burns hot and ignites a lot of the timber. And so, and they found out that depending on the forest, it's different for a tropical forest than it is for a temperate forest. It's also different for a dry forest, one that, say, gets 20 inches of rain, as opposed to a forest that gets 100 inches of rain. But depending on the forest type, what you want to maintain optimal growth for the forest is a forest fire every 20 to 100 years. And if you have a burn that's longer than 100 years, then it's going to be bad news for the forest. And this is what's caused people to realize, look, we need to be not quite so aggressive at trying to prevent forest fires from happening. Because if you don't get regular forest fires, it will not remove the leaf litter that's killing the nitrifying bacteria. And the other problem is you need regular forest fires to condition the soil. Because what a forest fire will do, and especially when you burn off all this leaf litter, it produces a soot, and the soot kind of seeps into the soil. And what that does is increases the water retention of the soil, which means the forest is able to survive on less rainfall than if there's never been a burn, or there hasn't been a burn in a long time. The other thing is that the ashes or the charcoal you get from the fire will work to transform a sandy soil into more of a clay-like soil. That helps retain the water, but also helps retain a lot of minerals, and therefore it fertilizes the forest. So it's a good thing to have forest fires, but you don't want them too often. If you have them too often, it'll consume the leaf litter too quickly. But neither do you want to wait too long before you have a forest fire, because if you wait too long, there's going to be such a toxic buildup from the decay of the leaf litter that'll wipe out the nitrifying bacteria. Bottom line, it's crucial that the leaves on the trees of the forest fall at a certain rate towards the forest floor. If they're not falling at a rapid enough rate, or they're falling at too rapid a rate, it's going to be bad news. And then you want the fires to be fine-tuned at an appropriate rate. And before human beings got involved in managing forests, what we noticed is all around the world, the forest fire rate was at an optimal level. And the leaf fall litter rate was at an optimal level. But kind of what we've been studying in Job and in Psalms is that we human beings have been put in charge of managing the planet for the benefit of all life, and sometimes we do the wrong thing. And therefore, it's crucial that we not disturb the rainfall patterns or the forest fire frequency or the leaf litter fall rate frequency. I mean, one of the things we've often done in parks, for example, is we'll sweep up all the leaf litter. or what they discovered in the Sierras, is that you got the problem with people climbing in the mountains of our high Sierras, sweeping up or accumulating dead leaves to start fires. And so what you've noticed is, starting about 15 years ago, it's now illegal to have a fire anywhere in the high Sierra. It doesn't matter what elevation you're at, what kind of rainfall you're at, and it's because they now recognize that it's important that the dead vegetation stay where it is. And likewise, they now have a policy that if a natural fire stops, they don't put it out. They let nature run its course. You had your first comment. Yes.
I'm just wondering, what are they doing about the reptiles, snakes, and lizards that run between rocks? They'll get charred. And you've got mammals, like raccoons, climb up in their little tree. They get charred. Hi!
Well, I don't know of any studies that have actually tried to measure the benefit of char from animals as opposed to char from the leaves and the trees. That'd be an interesting study to do. I mean, maybe that's fine-tuned as well, but I don't know of any study that's actually tried to identify the difference and what it's all about.
Can they save them in any way, or they just let them?
Well, you know, a few years ago, my wife and I led a group from Reasons to Believe down the fork of the Salmon River in Idaho. And we were going down that fork in a blazing forest fire. I mean, there was fires everywhere as we were going down the creek. We were the last ones allowed to go down. And quite often we had to stop our raft tour because of the fact that helicopters are coming in and scooping up water. But the thing that I noticed was the quantity of wildlife that was at the shore of the river. Little animals, big animals. And what was interesting is that often you get predators and herbivores literally side by side right at the water's edge trying to escape the fire, and they weren't harming one another. So, and what was a blessing is there was a lot of smoke and flames all around us, but we got to see, quote, wildlife like we no one's ever seen before. I mean, even bighorn sheep that live up in the high mountains were coming down to the water to get away from the flames. So, and maybe there's some fine-tuning in that, too. Who knows? No one's done a study, as far as I know, on whether that causes a redistribution of the fauna in the forest. I mean, maybe there's some benefit to that. I don't know. But it was a real treat for us to see the animals. That probably makes your point. A lot more animals escape than we would otherwise think from these situations. Okay, there's a hand here. Yes.
What's the benefit of the smoke that drops off in this fire?
What's the benefit of the smoke?
Is there any?
Well, yeah, there is. Because it's a particulate matter. And, you know, there are research studies we've written about it. If you go on our Today's New Reason to Believe site on our website at reasons.org, you'll find a number of articles that talk about the fine-tuning of particulate matter in the atmosphere that's crucial for sustaining waterfall, rainfall that's relatively even throughout the planet. One of the things we now know is that we're living in a period of the Earth's history where the rainfall is fairly evenly distributed over the continental land masses. It wasn't always like that. If you go back 250 million years, for example, there were huge deserts on the continental land masses. And before humanity started messing things up, the amount of land, continental land mass that was a desert was a relatively low percentage.
Have you seen an increase of the rainfall in the Sahara then?
Not yet. I mean, there's a real concern. They think they've stabilized the growth of the Sahara Desert in the last couple of years. And it's because people are trying to do what they can to prevent the sub-Saharan peoples from stripping the land of vegetation. But for example, I can remember in the 1960s and 1970s where the Sahara Desert was advancing southward at a rate of 6 miles a year. That rate has slowed down. Whether it's down to zero or not, I don't know. And the Gobi Desert currently is advancing at a rapid rate. In fact, they're claiming that probably within 15, 20 years, it'll be in the suburbs of Beijing.
Well, if they decrease the rate of growth of the Sahara, we're going to see a decrease in the rate of intensity of hurricanes coming our way on the East Coast?
Well, Keep in mind the Sahara Desert is now 10 times bigger than it was before human abuse became a factor. And so at that time, the rainfall over Africa was a lot more than it is right now. And likewise, the rainfall over the southern part of the Mediterranean, European Mediterranean, was greater. And so in that sense, things have been. But, you know, what causes hurricanes in the Atlantic is the South Tropical Atlantic Ocean getting really heated up. But in one sense, the hurricanes serve a big benefit. They act as a thermostat. When those oceans get really hot, hurricanes form. Hurricanes form huge cloud cover. They drop a lot of rain, which cools down the atmosphere and the land below. And so in that sense, hurricanes do serve a good purpose. But yeah, I mean, if you begin to disturb the ocean currents and you begin to disturb the plant cover or the continental land masses, it can have effects on the intensity and number of hurricanes and tornadoes. So that's something that needs to be watched. But in one sense, tornadoes and hurricanes are good. And we're talking about particulate matter. Hurricanes contribute particulate matter to the atmosphere, which causes rain to fall on the continental land masses. Smoke also will act as particulate matter to enhance rain. And by the way, viruses are a huge factor in rainfall formation. So as I was mentioning during the Skeptics Forum, there's a few things you want to remember to thank God for when you have your Thanksgiving dinner, and one of them might be viruses. If we don't have enough viral material, particulate matter being pumped into the atmosphere, likewise bacteria are a critical factor in making sure we got adequate rain over the continental land masses. I'm putting together an article for today's New Reason to Believe, talking about the miracle of the amount of rainfall we get in the continental land masses. As it is, 90% of the rain that falls on the oceans. Only 10% falls in the continental land masses. But it'd be very easy to have it go down to 1%. So, keeping it at that 10% level is critical. And one reason why it's as high as 10% is that the continents broke up. There used to be a supercontinent that broke up into smaller pieces, and the smaller pieces, thanks to continental drift, are fairly well separated today. And it's that separation that produces lots of continental coastal land area. And that's the place where you get the greatest rainfall with continental land masses. Where you get your big deserts is when you've got a huge area that's far away from an ocean or a body of water. And so the way the continents are shaped and distributed today minimizes the amount of land area that's thousands of miles away from the nearest body of water. But yeah, the particulate production is going to be most efficient on that region. One of the things that tornadoes do, for example, is they stir up a lot of big waves in the ocean, and that puts salt particles into the atmosphere. So unless we have adequate hurricanes, we're not going to get a sufficient injection of salt particles into the atmosphere, which can form little seeds along which rain will fall. By the way, raindrops will not form without some kind of nucleated seed, without some kind of particulate matter. So it needs that. Forming raindrops is not an easy thing to do. In fact, I tell students in my astronomy classes, it's far more difficult to form a raindrop than it is to form a star or a planet. Okay, go ahead.
This reminds me of driving along the roads back east. You will see woods back in the back that are kind of cleaned out, and you've got relatively big trees well spaced apart. And down near the road, there's always this thicket of small stuff, and it's this little one is preventing others from getting big. And I wonder if there's some mechanism that takes out the little stuff and leaves the bigger stuff.
Well, that again, I think you can somewhat pin on the blame of human beings. This photo, for example, was taken just a few feet from a road. And that seems to be the habit of human beings, is that when we have roads going through or houses going through, we don't let nature take its course because we don't want a fire right next to the highway. And so what happens when you drive down, I've seen this in Canada, you'd be driving down the highways, and yeah, you'll see the forest naturally thinned out once you get a couple of hundred yards away from the highway, but right next to the highway, it's just thick and overgrown. And that can be a problem. So the forests aren't as healthy next to the highways as they are a little bit away from the highways. In the back. Yeah, Jackie.
You mentioned the charcoal.
Yes.
And would that be fair also the charcoal from barbecue?
Yep. Yeah, so don't throw out your charcoal at your barbecue. It makes very good fertilizer for your soils. It'll help condition the soils. And incidentally, I've been trying to do this with my sons. I got a son that loves to barbecue for his friends. I said, when you clean the barbecue grill, that's especially good fertilizer because, after all, it's a lot of burnt meat, et cetera, and you've got all of those sauces that he loves to put on it. I says, you know, save all that stuff and then put it on the soil. So, yeah, don't throw that stuff away. It's
same
good.
Same thing with the ashes from your fireplace.
Yeah. Ashes from your fireplace, sure. Yeah. But especially if you're cooking over it, that really gives you a nice, rich fertilizing material. Go ahead.
Yeah, so in Job, what was that, 3000 B.C., when God gave us stewardship over the land. So, are we supposed to control the climate? Because that's what controls the forest. And how was it before 3000 B.C., before God gave us
God gave us the command somewhere between 50 and 80,000 years ago, because the command was given to Adam and Eve. So the first human beings got the command that they were to manage the planet for the benefit of themselves and all life. And in the book of Job, you've got three chapters, 37, 38, and 39, that give you explicit instructions on how to manage the planet for the benefit of all life. And yes, it does tell you to control the climate. I mean, today you've got people really worried about global warming, but what you'll see in the book of Job is it asks us to correct our abuses of the precipitation patterns over the planet.
Job was written 3,000 years ago. How did they know?
Probably 4,000 years ago.
But how did they know about Adam and Eve? Adam and Eve, they just say 80,000 years ago. That was Neanderthal time.
They wouldn't have been dumb, though.
Well,
dumb.
No, they weren't dumb, and the thing, you know, the thing about Job is that there's good evidence that it predates the book of Genesis by 400 to 600 years. And that would have put the book of Job before Hebrew became a written language. It was only an oral language at that time. But if you look at the book of Job, it's written in a such a way as to be easily memorized. Now you say it doesn't look that easy when you've got 42 chapters worth. But keep in mind, if you don't have a written language, then your society is going to really focus big time on memorization. You're going to memorize that which is really important. And so the fact that Job is set up in a poetic style that can be easily memorized means that they had a way to preserve the integrity of the text all those centuries before Hebrew became a written language. So Job didn't write the book of Job. Or his friends didn't write the book of Job. I think Elihu was probably the scribe.
Nobody knows who did.
So people have different ideas of who is responsible for preserving the text. But we do know that it didn't take written form until quite a bit later, because Hebrew wasn't in written form until that time. But what I'm saying is Adam and Eve could have passed on an oral message to their descendants that would have been preserved all the way up to the time of Job, all the way to the time of Moses, etc., and then it took written form. Now, you might be skeptical about that, but here's some evidence that that really is a rational conclusion. They now realize that the Haida legends, I'm talking about the Haida Indians that lived in the Queen Charlotte Islands off of British Columbia. It's not written, it's simply a memorized story of the origins of the Haida Indians. And that story talks about how they moved from the mainland of North America over to the Queen Charlotte's, and they didn't really have to go in boats because it was a land bridge. They walked across a land bridge to what are now the Queen Charlotte Islands, and once in the Queen Charlotte's, there came a period that they write about, or it had an oral transmission until it became written about 150 years ago, that there was a rapid rise in the level of the sea. and the level of the sea was so rapid that even though the Indians had mounted a plan to leave the islands and go back to the mainland before the sea levels got to be too high, they weren't able to carry it off because how rapid the sea level rose. And they actually record how it rose about 500 feet. Now, today we got carbon-14 dating tools that tell us when these events took place, and those tools also are able to tell us how accurate was their, quote, legend. We now realize it's not really a legend, it's an historical record because it's very accurate, but it actually records events going back 11,000 years ago. So for 11,000 years, here are these Indians that through oral means only retained a very accurate transmission of their early history. So if they could do it, why can't the people living in Asia and Europe do it?
Well, the Great Flood, worldwide flood, Noah's Ark.
Yes.
Was all, it wasn't true. So oral tradition is great, but it adds, people keep adding.
Well, let me dispute that, Al. You say it's not true.
Written stuff, you can't be sure of it.
There's a book, I don't have it now, I used to have it, but I think you can still get it. It's a book written by a European anthropologist, and what she records is how you can find an account of the flood in over 150 different kits throughout the world. So it says no matter where you go in the world, you'll find a story of early humanity experiencing a flood. And what she also documents is that as you proceed away from Mesopotamia and the time of, Abraham, and she's not a Christian writing this, but what she points out is that the degree of distortion is proportional to the distance and the time as you move from that event. And so her conclusion is the account we see in the Bible is the accurate account. And what we see in these other accounts is a progressive distortion depending on distance and time from the event. But her conclusion is something of this nature must have taken place. How else could you explain the ubiquitous nature of the story in all the cultures of the world? Now, the big debate, of course, is exactly what was the flood all about? And if you want to find out, there's a book over there on the table, The Genesis Question, which has 7 chapters worth on what that flood's all about.
When we went to Peru 3 weeks ago, I was reading about the Peru. The Peruvians, they also have a flood, but it's a local flood. And
yes.
Of course they think it's a worldwide flood. And they also have their deities. They have gods and stuff like that. But there again, I mean, do you believe in a worldwide flood?
I gave a lecture, Al, to a group of Christian leaders, and I purposely chose the title of my talk, Noah's Flood, Global or Worldwide, which stunned them because there was a lot of people, most of the people at this event believed in a global flood. So when they saw my title, Global or Worldwide, they said, what are you doing? And what I did is I took them through the Bible and picked up all those instances where it talked about worldwide events, where the text itself made it clear that it was not the entire globe. So I said, simply you proving from the Genesis text that it's a worldwide event doesn't mean it's a global event. In fact, what I did is I went into the text and showed them how in the Genesis text itself, it proves that it can't be a global event. And the problem is, people are reading it from a 20th and 21st century perspective. Today, when we talk worldwide, we mean the whole globe. That was not true in the 19th century. That was not true. Well, for example, one of the clearest texts is 2 Peter, where Peter distinguishes the extent of Noah's flood with the extent of the Roman Empire. And it was Paul who said in Romans 1 to the Roman Christians, your faith has been heard throughout the whole world. He meant the Roman Empire. He wasn't meaning that the Incas in Peru heard about the faith of the Christians in Rome. That was his world. But what Peter does in 2 Peter 3:6, he distinguishes the world of the Romans with the world of Noah, implying that the world of Noah was not as big as the world of Rome. And so he says the world at the time the event took place. You look at 2 Peter 3:6. In the actual Greek, it's cosmos tote. Now, if Peter meant to imply the entire planet, he would have not qualified the word cosmos. The word cosmos in Greek can mean the whole universe, it can mean the whole earth, it can mean the whole nation, the whole province or state, or the whole city, or your whole neighborhood. I mean, all those would qualify as cosmos. But if the word is not qualified, you tend to think of a bigger context for cosmos. So the fact that Peter chose to qualify the word means that it can't be the entire globe. In fact, he was implying it's actually smaller than the world of Noah. Now, I've got a couple of articles on our website that actually have readjusted our flood model from what you see in the Genesis question. We now believe that the flood of Noah inundated the entire Persian Gulf, inundated all of Mesopotamia, and a good chunk of southern Arabia. But that would be about it. And see, the point is, we now have a date for the flood of Noah based on calibrating the Genesis 11 genealogy that puts it at a time when the Persian Gulf was dry. Now, simultaneously, that solves another huge problem that skeptics of the Bible have raised. And that is the fact that Genesis 2 tells us that the Garden of Eden was at a place where the Gihon, the Pishon, the Tigris, and the Euphrates come together. Now, people have always known where the Tigris and Euphrates are, although those rivers do move over the course of thousands of years. They don't always have the same path. But today, we have satellite imagery that tells us where the Gihon and the Pishon are, and that is in southern Arabia. Now, those rivers flow very intermittently today because of the fact they don't get as much rainfall as they used to get. But the satellite imagery tells us that there were major rivers flowing 30, 40, 50,000 years ago in southern Arabia, the Pihon and the Gishon. And in fact, if you go up the Gihon, it takes you right into Ethiopia. And there was a land bridge. See, the Red Sea was dry as well. And so it would have been an easy walk to go from Eden into Ethiopia, eastern Africa, where we see all the genetic diversity of early humanity. But as you trace these four rivers into the Persian Gulf, what you discover is in the southeastern part of the Persian Gulf, the four rivers come together in one location. So we've adjusted our model to say we think the Garden of Eden is probably in what is now the southeastern part of the Persian Gulf, but it also makes the flood of Noah a little bit bigger than the traditional old earth creationist model. And again, if you read Genesis chapter 8, it's very consistent with that because I found at this conference I was at, the biggest argument that young earth creationists put forward for a global flood was Genesis 7:19, where it says the waters of the flood covered all the high mountains. Now, one thing I've always known is that phrase high mountains in the original Hebrew can also mean elevated hills. It doesn't have to be inundating, for example, Mount Ararat. But what you notice in Genesis chapter 8, verse 5, the waters are receding. So it stopped raining, and there's still, you know, snow melt filling up the basin. But as Noah's watching the level drop, he sends out, he gets on top of the ark, and there he can see the distant hills. But verse 9, which is later in the chronology, he releases a dove. And the dove flying low over the water, as it says in the text, there's water over the whole face of the earth, which means the dove could not see any land. All it could see was water from one end of the horizon to the other. But the interesting thing is, it's the same phraseology you see in Genesis 7:19. So the very same Hebrew phraseology is used in both passages. And in Genesis 8, it's clear that it's not claiming that the entire planet is inundated with water, only that from Noah's perspective in Genesis 7:19, he couldn't see any landmass, water from one horizon to the other, which means we're looking at, say, a 50-mile radius around the ark for which there was no land sticking up. Yes?
I'd like to make a comment. One of those episodes of the dove comes back with a fresh olive leaf.
That's later in the text.
Yeah.
So after verse 9, he sends out a dove again, and this time the dove finds land and brings back an olive branch, with olive leaves on it. But see, that in itself proves it can't be a global flood. If it was a global flood, those olive leaves would not be intact. Yeah, go ahead.
My question is about rainfall today.
Rainfall today, right.
Go back to that. Would we benefit from certain kinds of cloud seeding today that might better manage our rainfall on the continental land masses and cool the earth to some degree?
Well, the message of Job 37 and 38, we'll do what we can to correct the rainfall patterns that we've disturbed. That will kind of take care of everything else. And so I'm writing a book on this now where I make the point, you know, in terms of worrying about global warming, really the way to go is to look where we disturb the precipitation patterns of the planet, restore it to where it was before we abused it, and incidentally, that will take care of the global warming problems we're facing as a byproduct. And so in one sense, all this attention on global warming is not examining the root of the problem. Part of the root of the problem is what we've done to disturb the rainfall patterns. Another part of the problem is what we've done to disturb the animal biomass on the planet. And that's what Job 39 deals with. So we'll take those two corrective actions. I argue that that would be our best bet to resolve global warming. And in both cases, there's an economic benefit to the human species. So we don't have to ask anybody for a tax or some kind of economic disincentive to resolve global warming. This is something that's a win-win. You're going to have more money in your pocketbook. At the same time, we're going to be able to restore the planet to the condition that God gave it to us thousands of years ago. So the book will be out in a few months. So, yeah, I don't know who's over here. All right. I don't know who's first in this class, so go ahead.
On the leaf litter, if there's any simple indicator that could show whether it's optimal or suboptimal, any observations you've made on the leaf litter?
Well, kind of what I was doing here, John, is showing that there's at least three different fine-tuning aspects. Okay, and then in response to a question over here, it looks like there may be more. Kind of what I'm recommending in the paper I've written on this is that, you know, there's something going on here that we need to pay attention to. And we're kind of seeing the tip of the iceberg, but I believe there's a lot more design evidence that can come out of this if we'll simply devote sufficient study. For one thing, I think 5 years was way too short. This study needs to be extended because it only revealed a few fine-tuning aspects. There could be more if we were to dig in a little bit deeper, but also showed you it's complicated. I mean, you've got forest fires, you've got particulate matter, you've got the plants, you've got the animals, the rainfall patterns. This is not as easy as it may seem to pick out the fine-tuning. It's a lot different than the baryon study we talked about last Sunday. You know, the wonderful thing about astronomy is we're dealing with things that are just so very simple that the fine-tuning is just really obvious to us. When you get into biology, it's orders of magnitude more complex. But in that sense, it's more exciting because there's so much more that you can dig out of it if you'll just simply structure the study the right way. And one thing I'd like to add, too, from a biblical perspective, I think we can design experiments that are going to be more productive in terms of the research output. So this is kind of giving us a guide of what kind of studies we should do.
So for land managers, they still wouldn't have any way to know whether their leaf litter was excessive or inadequate.
Well, the authors of this study basically said, look what we have found, and this tells us that we need to be circumspect about what we do with the leaf litter, and we need to give this more study. In fact, they kind of ended their study with kind of a subtle appeal for more funding to, you know, do more research. Yeah, go ahead. We got a botanist here speaking.
One of the best indicators of the health of an ecosystem is the floristic diversity. So when you see a relative monoculture,
yeah.
And another benefit of the smoke that somebody implied earlier is the chemicals in smoke have a beneficial effect on the seeds of successional plants that repopulate after a fire, which need exposure to those chemicals and the heat sometimes to germinate.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, there's some seeds that won't germinate unless they are stimulated by the heat of a forest fire. So, Yeah, I think something else you pointed out here too, John, is that the leaf litter looks like it's all coming from just a few species. So, in fact, most of it seemed to come just from one. Yeah, in the back, Mary. What's my date for the flood? Oh, I'm putting it around 40,000 years ago, plus or minus 20,000 years. So.
It felt like to be wrong.
Well, it's simply pointing out that our capacity to date early human events just isn't that accurate. I mean, people are expecting us to come. Like for the age of the Earth, I can give you a figure that's accurate to five places of the decimal. For early human history, it's not even one place of the decimal. So, yeah, give us a break. Yeah, go ahead.
I know there's no such thing as a silly question, but I'll make an exception right now.
You're talking about him or yourself? I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Anyways, the flood. Now, the rainbow thing, was that a natural phenomenon, or is that really the sign of God saying no more floods?
It's both. The answer is yes to both. In the sense that it is a natural phenomenon, but God is using it as a sign for the contract he's making with the human species. Now, you'll see that God does that 9 times throughout the Bible. And each time he picks something that the humans are already familiar with. And so he says, see these rainbows that you've been experiencing for thousands of years? From now on, that rainbow is going to be a sign that I'm going to keep the promise I made to you. When you see the rainbow, they'll remind you that I've made a promise with you.
Well, obviously there have been rainbows. There were rainbows
before. There are rainbows before and rainbows after, yeah.
Just a slight detour off this. God created Adam and Eve, and Adam and Eve had Cain and Abel. Without incest, how did the population
increase? Well, very good insight. In fact, you'll see an article on our website, where did Cain get his wife and where did he get all the people to populate a city? Because it doesn't only say he got a wife. It says he built a city and populated it. Now, here he was an outcast. So the human population had to be significant just for him to be able to populate that city. Now, the question is, without incest. Okay, what's interesting when you look at the Levitical law, the law that you see in the book of Leviticus, is that it defines incest as intercourse between parents and children, but it does not define it as intercourse between brothers and sisters. And the thing you notice in the book of Genesis is that Abraham was married to a sister. Sarah was his half-sister. Now, what you do notice in the Levitical law, however, once you get outside the moral law that you see in the book of Leviticus, you've got Moses saying, from this point onward, we're not going to have brother-sister marriages. Why? So that we will not suffer the diseases of the Egyptians. In other words, it wasn't a moral law, it was a medical law. And you know what all the Israelites would have observed in their sojourn in Egypt is the fact that hemophilia was afflicting the royal family. And the reason it afflicted the royal family is that their religion was such that the Pharaoh was God. And God could only marry another god. He couldn't marry a mere human being. And so the Pharaoh was not allowed to marry anyone except his sister. But that went on for successive generations. And if you do that for successive generations, you will wind up propagating genetic defects. But if you only do it for a few generations, or if you've got interruptions between the times that it happens, and it happens early in the history of humanity, the genetic risk is relatively low. In fact, if people know this when they're trying to come up with a new breed of a dog or a cow or a cat or whatever, is the way they breed a new breed, is that they will force the mating of brothers and sisters in order to get a particular characteristic that they want to isolate. But anybody who does animal breeding realizes you can only do that up to a certain point. And then we have breeds, for example, that we label as being overbred, and which means they're genetically weakened. And it's because they had to impose too many brother-sister arrangements with those dogs or cats or whatever. But you can get away with it if it's incidental. If it's long-term and repeated, then it's going to cause a problem. So today, for example, as part of the law of the Bible, not part of the moral law, but part of the medical law, is that we don't allow brothers and sisters to marry. But in Genesis, it was okay. In the book of Exodus, it's not okay, because now we're later in the history of humanity.
Eve, they would have to have done it with the mother, right?
Oh, no, not at all.
So where are the other sisters?
Okay, Genesis chapter 5.
Sisters? I'm sorry, I didn't know.
Genesis chapter 5 says that Adam and Eve had Cain, Abel, and Seth, and many sons and daughters beside.
Oh, okay.
Now, what you'll see in our website is a little table calculating how rapidly the human population would multiply if murder wasn't a significant problem. We believe it was. But presuming murder wasn't a significant problem, there would have been over 6 billion people on the face of the earth by the time Adam was 700 years of age.
Wow.
Well, that's because, at best, if you're living to be 800 or 900 years old, at best you're going to have 150 children minimum per couple. Because after all, the best birth control method Adam and Eve would have had at their disposal would have been the rhythm method. And they didn't have thermometers. So at best, they're going to be able to limit. I mean, some people think that there's probably going to be one child every 2 years. But let's say they were really resolute in trying to prevent birth, you're still going to get at least one every 4 years. And in that case, it's a minimum of 150 children per couple. And just work out the math. You'll see that the population rises dramatically. But we use that as a proof that murder must have been completely out of control in the days before the flood. Otherwise, how do you explain the low human population at that time? For example, we have no fossil remains of people before the flood. And the only explanation of that is the human population must have been very much repressed. And so on that basis, we calculate in the days before the flood, you're probably looking at least 19 out of 20 people dying from murder, not from natural causes. And in fact, it's an argument that today we may have the longest average lifespan that humans have ever experienced. Even though a few were living to be 869 years old in the days before the flood, today we have a longer average lifespan than people who are living in Noah's generation.
If somebody lives to 900 years old, don't they go crazy with ornaments?
They didn't even have video games, right? Didn't have computers. I mean,
the first 300 is okay, but then what do you do?
Now, there's just too many jokes that could be pulled out of this, so I'm just going to let this go.
Wait, are you trying to tell me an 800-year-old man can have sex with an 800-year-old woman and produce a child?
Well, let's just presume it's like us today. I mean, today we're reproductive for a little more than two-thirds of our lifespan. And so if Adam and Eve were reproductive for two-thirds of their lifespan, that means they're reproductive for at least 600 years. And if they're having one child every 4 years minimum, not including twins, that's 150 offspring that they have just from their marriage.
That's quite a family reunion.
That's quite a family reunion. But it explains why it would be relatively easy for Cain to find a woman to marry and relatively easy to find a few thousand people to populate the city that he was constructing. Because the human population would have exploded quite quickly. Now, if you read Genesis chapter 4, it talks about a descendant of Cain that had murdered many men, not just one man. So that's an indication. By the time you get about five or six generations removed from Cain, the murder rate is really at a high level. And again, to explain the low population at the time of the flood, after all, you've got humanity sitting around for at least 10,000 years, maybe 20, 30,000 years, and the human population is very suppressed in spite of these long lifespans. Murder must have been completely out of control, and it's consistent with what you see in Genesis 6, where it says, except for Noah and his family, every human being had evil thoughts all the time, and every action from a human being to a fellow human being was one of malice. Now, the Hebrew word for there is physical violence, which means every time two people got together, somebody got hurt.
Was there any justice imposed at that time?
Apparently not.
So then after the flood, is that when they started developing sort of a justice?
Well, it also explains, because after the flood, God speaks to Noah and says, now you have to impose justice. He says, I will not tolerate this murder rate any longer. And basically tells Noah, if necessary, impose a death penalty for people who kill their fellow man. And so from the time of the flood onwards, it was given to human society, not to individuals, but to the government, to use the death penalty if necessary to restrain the expression of evil. It wasn't a command, but it says this is how far you can go. Now, it's also in the Levitical law points out there's a limit. You can only kill the murderer. You cannot do anything to his family or his relatives. Only the one that kills can be put to death. And there was provision for the one who murdered to be shown mercy. He didn't have to be put to death. On the other hand, the command is clear that society is responsible to restrict the expression of murder. And you need to exercise justice to make sure it doesn't get out of control. I think you're next, and then I've been ignoring this side of the class. So,
politically motivated thought here that's been on my mind, Proposition 8, opposition, has clearly come out and said they favor marriage between any two people. And I'm wondering when the question is going to directly come up about brother and sister marriages, which they seem to not have any problem with or not want to exclude from that. And that then would have medical consequences that would be unacceptable.
Well, I've been puzzled about that politically myself. I mean, here we've had this vote about whether we're going to allow two women to get married or two men to get married. And actually, our Supreme Court ruled on it in the late 1890s. And basically, the Supreme Court ruled on whether or not Mormons could have more than one wife, whether a Mormon man could have more than one wife. And the Supreme Court ruled at that time a marriage is one man and one woman committed to each other for life, and that's the standard for raising children. So it's like all these votes we're having are unnecessary. The Supreme Court has already ruled on it in the context of Mormons. And if you open up the door and say that two men can get married and raise a family, adopt kids, then look what happened in the Netherlands. They formed a law like that, but then they found themselves trapped saying, well, what about three men getting married? Or two men and a woman getting married? Or what do you do about a man marrying a child? And so they found themselves trapped into having to expand marriage definition to such a great degree that almost anything goes. And actually, the Netherlands, in response to that, has now gone to a strict definition of marriage. Because basically, they tried it for 15 years and said, this isn't working. It's destroying the family structure. It's not good for the children. Let's get back to basics. No problem with two men sharing an apartment. But if they're going to have a marriage that's going to be established as a means, a vehicle for raising children for life, then it needs to be, as the Bible states, one man, one woman, that are committed to one another for life. Because after all, it's going to take 20 years to raise children. If the marriage only lasts a couple of years, this isn't going to work. And incidentally, in today's society, I think it takes 30 years to raise the children, not just 20 years. So maybe we need stricter laws today. So there's a hand over here that I've been ignoring. So anybody? No? Okay. One more, and then we got to close. And by the way, I'm sorry about not getting to the lesson, but this is a fun time. Yeah, go ahead.
Comment and question. I think if you look at the text carefully, Cain and Abel were not necessarily the first two children. There could have been children before.
There could have been, yeah. It doesn't say that Cain was the firstborn.
Question. NASA's recent orbital evidence that the glaciers, I believe in Greenland, were receding at half the rate that they thought. What do you think that has? What kind of effect?
Well, we've been reading the articles on the Greenland glaciers, and you can definitely see that there's a lot more Greenland ice being melted. The problem is how much Greenland ice is forming. And so the big question is, are we seeing a decrease in the total mass of ice over Greenland, or are we simply seeing an increase in the amount of ice that's being melted? The two may not be the same. Now, in terms of the global warming picture, where it's a little bit easier to get a handle is to measure the ice mass over the Arctic cap. Because that's a lot easier to work with. You don't have to kind of measure the depth of the ice. And but in the case of the Arctic ice cap, there's clear evidence that it is melting at a very rapid rate. In fact, the ice cap is only half the size that it was 150 years ago. And for that reason, it's now possible. Remember, I remember in Canada, I don't know whether they do this here in the States, but in Canada, when we were kids and kind of reading the history of North America, there was a lot of attention on what was called the Northwest Passage, a quest to open up a shipping lane across northern Canada. And about all the explorers who wound up getting their boats stuck and dying because of the thickness of the ice there and the severity of the Canadian northern winter. Well, today, the Northwest Passage is open. We can send big freighters through the Northwest Passage because of how much of ice has melted there. So there may be a question about what's going on in Greenland. It's even more problematic what's happening in Antarctica. And it's not so much the temperature. It's temperature plus precipitation you've got to take into account. So sometimes, for example, people dispute it. Yeah, Greenland's getting warmer, but those warmer conditions are causing more snow to fall over Greenland. And so it's disputable whether the ice pack on Greenland is greater or smaller with respect to time. Now, there are people doing research there right now. I would think within about 2 years we'll have an answer to your question. But I can't give it to you today. But in the case of the Arctic, we got a clear answer. Okay, with that, I'm going to have to close. And next week, I'm not going to get into a scientific discovery. I've learned my lesson from this week. I thought, you know, this would work this week because, after all, we had the skeptics forums where we talked about all these things. So I thought this week I'll give a short to scientific discovery and jump into the lesson. Next week, I'm going to skip the scientific discovery. We'll zip right into the lesson.
We'll see.
We'll see. All right. But, you know, I think one of the fun things about this class is that we allow open discussion. So I encourage you, bring your questions and comments. Bring your friends who've got questions and comments, because this is not a sermon you get from me. I think all adult classes should be teaching and never preaching. And teaching means you get people to get engaged in the learning process. It's not just somebody giving a straight-up lecture. Occasionally I'll do that here. But really, I see my role as a teacher, not as a preacher. So with that, Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the day and age in which we live, and with so many exciting discoveries are giving us a bigger and bigger book of nature. Thank you, Lord, as you gave us two books, the book of Scripture and the book of nature. How both support one another and cooperate one another, but both, Lord, are growing in terms of the revelation to us. Lord, thank you for Bev's testimony about how, no matter how much we can study your books, the 66 books that make up the Bible, there's always more to learn. So, Lord, I pray that you give each of us the motivation to dig in that book and make more discoveries. And likewise, to dig into the book of nature and make more discoveries so we can be taught by you. And, Lord, as we're taught by you, help us to submit to you and receive from you new life in Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
You're writing a book about climate change in the present, right?
Let me turn this off.